afternoon. House Finance on the record. It is 2:20 p.m. on Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022. Present today are Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will consider House Bill 226, Increases for State Attorneys, and House Bill 416, Bonuses for Non-Union Public Employees, and then we will continue our discussion of the capital budget. We will begin with House Bill 226, Increases for State Attorneys, by Representative Josephson. Let the record reflect we are joined by Vice Chair Ortiz as well. This is the bill's second hearing. We last heard this on April 29th, and amendments were due to my office yesterday. There are four amendments for consideration. Representative Josephson, do you have opening comments?
May I make them from here?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, just to bring this back where we're all preoccupied with lots of different issues, I have been the subcommittee chair for the Department of Law for 4 years. I wasn't going looking for another problem to solve, but the department would present over and over annually about its difficulties retaining attorneys. It's extreme, it's chronic, and it's something of a crisis. And for that reason, I offer this this bill. Appreciate you carrying it again. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we're going to move to public testimony on House Bill 226. I will remind folks that we are limiting public testimony today to 2 minutes. And with that, I'm opening public testimony on House Bill 226. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 226? Great.
Hi.
Madam, please step forward. Yes, place yourself on the record and begin your 2-minute testimony. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bailey Wolfstead. I'm from Juneau, and I'm testifying in my personal capacity. I'm a prosecutor in the Office of Special Prosecutions, Rural Prosecution Unit, working the Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Grant. I'm here to urge you to pass House Bill 226, but also to explain to you why the bill simply doesn't go far enough. Prosecutors working 60 to 80 hour work weeks, in addition to being on call 24/7 to assist officers in emergent situations and cover every single court holiday. I worked Christmas last year. We don't get paid for on-call or overtime. The jobs we work take a toll on us. I spent my morning looking with a defense attorney at some child pornography, as well as looking through crime scene and autopsy photos of a 10-year-old child to determine which to attach to a sentencing memorandum for her rapist and murderer. Those are photos I can never unsee and that I will never forget. We leave our families. I traveled 78 days last year for work, mostly to Western Alaska. I've traveled 38 days so far in 2022. Inflation has increased dramatically since 2015. In the last few years, I've seen friends and colleagues leave state service for municipalities, Washington, and the feds, where they have lower caseloads, less stressful work, and they're paid significantly more and have pensions. It's been frustrating to sit back and watch as the legislature recognizes the value of everyone's work except for ours. We've seen SU, GGU, DPS receive significant raises and COLAs while we've been left behind. Maybe it's because we're not unionized. House Bill 226 doesn't do enough to keep attorneys and make us competitive. The recruitment and retention crisis is not limited to DPS. Police can do a stellar investigation, but the most they can do is make an arrest or forward charges. It's your prosecutors who argue bail, meet with victims, present cases, perform motion work, negotiate, and try cases with the ultimate end goal of a sentence and supervision. We're key players on this team, and without us, public safety is not adequately addressed. Yet we're leaving in droves because the legislature has not recognized us for our value and other governments do. I ask now that you pass this bill, but that also you do more and do better. A 40-hour work week, address on-call pay, keep our cost of living adjustment and salaries in step and on par with our law enforcement colleagues here in the state and on a national level. We work so very hard to support Alaska and to keep Alaska safe, and I simply ask that you all support us as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Wolfstein. We appreciate you coming in, and thank you for your emotional testimony. We appreciate you sharing that. Next up in the room, it looks like we have Kevin Higgins. Welcome back to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your two-minute testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Kevin Higgins. I am here in my personal capacity, but I am an attorney in the Civil Division of the Department of Law. I'm here to ask you to support HB 226. The testimony and discussion on pay bills has been consistent. No matter what the pay bill has been, recruitment and retention are issues that we face. If you don't pay people enough, people leave the positions they're in. Once people leave the positions, the workload becomes unsustainable for those who stay, and so they leave. And you can't recruit people to fill the empty positions. And if you do recruit them, by the time you get them trained, they're more marketable and they go somewhere else. These services that we're talking about on HB 226 are not services that the state can do without. Prosecutors, defense attorneys, they are required. Civil attorneys who advise agencies helping to implement the administration's policies and defending the state against claims. The state has to pay for these services one way or another. If there's not a staff of a good and dedicated attorneys on hand, the state will have to go out to the open market and contract these at competitive rates, probably to the attorneys who just left the department. Paying staff makes good economic sense. Without a defined benefit plan, pay is the only lever you have to pull. I ask that you pull it and please pass HB 226.
Great, thank you, Mr. Higgins. I see no questions. We appreciate you being here today. I'll have the record reflect at 2:24 p.m. we were joined by Representatives Rasmussen and Carpenter. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one, we will move online. It looks like in Juneau we have Samantha Weinstein. Ms. Weinstein, if you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your two-minute testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Samantha Weinstein, and I'm testifying today in support of HB 226 to increase the pay for state attorneys, and I urge you to implement this raise at the beginning of the upcoming fiscal year. I'm testifying in my personal capacity today, but I am testifying because I was a former Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Division of the Department of Law. I left at the beginning of April because I was burned out. It was exciting to be hired by the biggest law firm in the state. I was looking forward to a steady paycheck, actually having benefits, and the opportunity to learn from the experts who had been working there for years. That excitement ran out. Over the last 3.5 years, I watched two attorney generals resign in disgrace, a governor of section supervisors who quit or retired, and I lost count of the number of my coworkers who slowly trickled out to municipalities, the federal government, private practice, and the lower 48. In my job search, it was clear why. The positions offered better pay, better benefits, a better work-life balance, and more opportunities for growth. These employers were showing the value that attorneys held in their workplace. We are but human. Carrying the workloads of 2 to 4 people unsurprisingly burns us out. I saw and felt the resulting physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion from the chronic stress. Not only physical symptoms, but also the increased cynicism and detachment from the job, a sense of ineffectiveness, and a lack of accomplishment. Burnout is running rampant through Alaska state workers, including assistant attorneys general. An increase to match inflation since 2016 is the absolute least the legislature could do to support their state workers. Even now, at the beginning of May, they don't know if there will be a budget on July 1st, or if this increase will be reflected in it, or even if it will be in next year's budget. People have already begun to assume that it won't, and it's demoralizing. Please help us see what's possible and pass this raise to meet inflation effectively.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Weinstein. We really appreciate you being here today. I see no one else in the room wishing to testify. Is there anyone else online? Seeing none, I will close public testimony on House Bill 226. Excuse me. And that takes us to amendments. Amendment number one by Representative Thompson. Is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I move amendment number one. Object.
There's been an objection. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Before I go into amendment number one, I have a conceptual amendment that was recommended by Nancy Mead. And what it does is on page 3, line 22, it deletes 5 words. Other than justices and judges. And Ms. Mead is here to explain, if necessary, why the amendment.
Great. I will object to your conceptual amendment for purpose of discussion. If Ms. Mead, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I approached the sponsor of Amendment 1 to request that that phrase, other than justices or judges, be removed. In general, this amendment would provide for a 5% pay increase for all non-covered employees. Section 6 of the amendment says that it would also apply to the judicial branch, which, of course, we are very much in support of. However, I believe it may have been a drafting issue. I don't think it was a conscious determination by the sponsor to exclude the judges and justices. But excluding them in this bit of uncodified law creates a conflict with a four statutory provisions. Within Title 22, that sets up the judgeships and describes laws surrounding the four different levels of judges. There are specific provisions that say, I'll sort of read quickly, if the monthly base salary of in Title 39 increases, the monthly base salary of a judge or a justice shall increase by the same percentage. So because of that, it would be a conflict to have uncodified law saying that even though this would raise the chart by 5%, that judges and justices were excluded. So I do believe they need to be excluded because of that provision. And if I could just add very quickly, that provision was added in 2006 with respect to the judges for a very good reason, and that is unless judges and justices keep pace with all the other raises that all other non-covered employees get, and at times they had been excluded, we end up in a position that's uncomfortable both for the court system and for the legislature, where we need to come in and ask for a very big raise every once in a while so that our judges aren't completely ranked at number 50 in terms of judicial salaries around the country. So it's meant to make sure that they keep pace and don't get excluded.
Great, thank you, Ms. Mead. Questions regarding conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to the conceptual amendment? Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Mead. That takes us back to amendment number 1 as amended. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This amendment, as amended, recommends a 5% cost of living adjustment for exempt employees in the legislative and executive branches. Exempt employees have not received increases or salary adjustments since 2016. In the meantime, non-exempt employees, either in the general government units or the SU supervisory unit, have received increases for cost of living totaling over 5%. It's a matter of fairness that exempt employees receive the same COLA increase as those of the GGU and SU bargaining units. The total cost of enacting this legislation for the executive and legislative branches is projected to be $13,211,900, of which $720,100 is UGF. And I have my Chief of Staff, Tom, right here with me to explain and answer any additional questions. But he'll give a breakdown of this so I can have Tom come up.
Great, thank you. Mr. Wright, please place yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Tom Wright, and I'm staff to Representative Thompson. As Representative Thompson has alluded, since 2016, FY 2016, the exempt non-covered employees, both in the administration and in the legislature, have not received a COLA or seen an increase in their cost of living. GGU, since that time, has approximately 23.5% total in cost of living. In FY 22, 23, and 24, or excuse me, FY 20, 21, and 22, they received a 5% increase. And just recently, a new contract has been approved, which gives them, starting in 2023, a 3% increase, the next year a 2.5% increase, and possibly in 2025, a 5% increase. And that 5% increase is based on CPI as of July 1st, 2022. And according to Alexi, that 5% increase is going to be automatic because we're already there. For SU, in 2019, they received a 40-hour work week, which equates to a 6.25% increase. And they also received a 5% increase starting in 2022 at 3%, and then 1% the following year, and 1% the following year. So essentially, they've had approximately a 16% increase. And one of the things that struck home in your first testifier was saying that, who said we haven't had a cost of living increase since FY 2016, and that would help alleviate some of the retention problems possibly. I'm not saying it will be the end all. There'll still be retention problems, recruitment problems, but this will help alleviate some of that situation. And I could get into more information if you'd like, but I think I've pretty well covered, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Just wondering if there's any questions from the committee.
I will ask that. Representative Wohl.
Thank you. You mentioned the hours was reduced to 40 hours a week, and that equates to a 6% increase. I understand if someone's working, and I don't know what the hour requirement was before that, and so I guess maybe that's what were the hourly requirement of someone beyond 40 hours? I wasn't aware of that. And secondly, if your hours are knocked down to 40 hours a week, which we conventionally call full-time work, and there's no pay increase, I understand the dollar per hour as it goes up, but certainly someone trying to pay a mortgage, it makes no difference.
And I'd like to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Klayman. Thank you for being here. Mr. Wright?
And also Skiff Lobaugh is on the line from personnel, and he can talk about this as well. But what happened in 2019 for the SU, for the supervisory unit, they went from 37.5 hours per week to a 40-hour week work week. And I don't know what the exact percent was, but according to the information I had for the year, it was a 6.25% increase for those additional 2.5 weekly hours.
Representative Wohl.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. I thought it went down to 40 with no pay increase, so you're saying that's an effective increase. But you're saying it went from 37.5 to 40 with additional pay, so they got an increase but also worked more. But even with that calculation, it was still an overall increase.
Well, and as the first testifier said, she's been working a number of hours, up to 60, 70 hours a week. And so that 40-hour work week wouldn't really cover it, but it does mean more pay by going to that 40-hour work week.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would appreciate some context. We heard from some attorneys, and I don't remember whether they were from Department of Law or our own legislative attorneys. I apologize for coming in late. So the question that I have is, if we are looking at hiring a new attorney, where do they fall on the range and step? Collective bargaining agreement, and then ones that are not.
Would that be a Skiff Lobaugh question?
Madam Chair, I'd prefer to have Skiff answer that, please.
All right. We have Human Resources Manager Skiff Lobaugh online. Thank you for being here at House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and respond to Representative Carpenter.
My name's Skiff Lobaugh, Human Resource Manager, Legislative Affairs Agency. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, there are no attorneys in the legislative branch that are covered under collective bargaining. So all of the attorneys on the legislative branch would be paid through the salary schedule adopted in 3927011A. Attorneys in the legislative branch will generally start between ranges 23 to 25, depending on experience, years of experience.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Do we have anybody available that can tell us where the starting, a comparable figure is for the state employees who are under the collective bargaining?
It looks like we have someone from the Public Defender Agency, and I think that is it. Mr. Wright.
Madam Chair, if I remember correctly, none of the attorneys in the Department of Law or in the Department of Administration are covered by a union. They're basically non-covered employees. So that doesn't answer the question, but I just wanted to point that out.
Great, thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Well, it makes finding the answer a lot easier if there is no union involved. So, I mean, that does kind of answer the question. So thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number one?
Do we have anyone from Ledge Legal on the phone?
We do not, unless they are under another tab here for another bill. I do not see anyone from Ledge Legal online. We can try to get somebody, if that would be helpful.
I think it would be.
Great. My staff will reach out to Ledge Legal, and in the meantime, we will go to Representative Wohl.
Yeah, thank you. I was just inquiring if there are other attorneys working for the state that are non-legislative branch, such as Ledge Legal, for example. They're in the legislative branch, I'm assuming, that are under collective bargaining in some other non-legislative branch, just as a comparison. But just my question.
Mr. Wright?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so, but that's probably better left to Division of Personnel to answer that, but I don't think there are, but again.
Mr. Lobaugh, is that something that you can help with?
Once again, Skip Lobaugh, Human Resource Manager, Legislative Affairs. I have the same understanding as Tom does. I do not know of any that are under collective bargaining. My understanding is that they're under the partially exempt and exempt services. Which would also be covered under the AS 3927-0118 salary schedule. But Division of Personnel would be the one who could really answer anything with respect to that. For executive branch positions, I can tell you that all the legislative branch attorneys are in the exempt service, and that includes legislative legal as well as the Office of Victims' Rights. We have several attorneys there as well.
Great, thank you very much. And we're going to take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 2:47 p.m., and we are going to go to Representative Carpenter with a question for Human Resources.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Very basic question. Can you please describe or explain to me what the process is for changing from a range 6 to a range 7, for example, or just moving up the range scale? And the same thing, same question for moving up the step scale.
Mr. Lobaugh?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, ranges are determined, are basically the class of work that the employee is determined to do. A range like a certain job class, generic job class, would be, I'll use personnel because I'm very versed with them. You have human resource, personnel assistants, range 14, 15, 16. The 14 would be more in the payroll, 15 would be more in the payroll. As you get further up into personnel, the higher ranges would be payroll supervision, and then you get into investigations, human resource manager. The ranges would go up as the level and complexity and error, possibility of error, consequence of error, sorry, increases. And that would be the same in the attorney job classes as people are, whether they're starting out with respects to journeyman, beginning drafting, they're edited more. You look more at the drafting until you get a full higher range drafter, which would be up to the 25 when I gave you the 23, 24, 25 with respect to attorneys for starting. Now, the steps are what are considered meritorious service, depending on length of time and if you are recommended by your supervisor that you would get a step increase. So steps are time in the range grade. Range is what the work is determined to be allotted to it for the job classification. Does that make sense?
Representative Carpenter.
Yes, thank you. I understand meritorious service plus time and range for a step increase and a job classification change would give you potentially a range increase. What is the time and range requirement or requirement before you move to a step, assuming you've got a meritorious service recommendation?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, you would, from A through F step is 1 year. From F on, it's 2 years.
Thank you. We will go to Representative Josephson. We now have Noah Klein with Legislative Legal Services online, as well as Megan Wallace, Director of Legislative Legal. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, just want to doubly confirm what I believe for Mr. Klein. Does the amendment, that is amendment number one by Representative Thompson, does it mesh seamlessly and without interference with version G of the bill?
Mr. Klein, thanks for being here.
This is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, for the record. To Representative Josephson through the chair, I'm not sure what question you're asking when you say, does it mesh seamlessly with the bill?
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Klein, thank you. What I mean is, although it changes the policy calls because it adds new policies, does it in any way delete, alter, or otherwise affect directly subsection G, or rather, version G of the bill?
To the chair, to Representative Josephson, again, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, for the record. The only way, depending on how you want to characterize affecting version G of the bill, Amendment 1 is increasing the salary table, and so the 10% increase for attorneys that's in the underlying bill would be 10% of that increased table.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number one? Representative Josephson.
Yes, I had the objection, I withdraw.
Great, thank you. Is there further objection on amendment number one as amended.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 2:54 p.m., and I'd like the record to reflect at 2:53 we were joined by Representative Edgman, and we would like to wish the Rules Chair a very, very happy birthday today. And with that, is there further objection to Amendment Number 1 as amended? Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 as amended has been adopted. Amendment Number 2 by Representative Thompson. Do you have a motion?
Madam Co-Chair, I move Amendment Number 2.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Co-Chair. I would like my Chief of Staff, Tom Wright, to explain Amendment Number 2 to the body.
Thank you. Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record again, Tom Wright, staff to Representative Thompson. Since we are talking increases in pay, you know, to other attorneys, Representative Thompson and I discussed this, and Representative Thompson thought it'd be fair if we increase the salaries of the legislative attorneys as well. And that's basically what this amendment does.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. I know that those folks work very diligently for us. Is there further discussion on Amendment Number 2?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Without a doubt, they've earned it.
Thank you. And I will note we now have Kate Sheehan, the Director of Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, on the line to help answer questions. Representative Wohl on Amendment Number 2?
Indirectly. Okay, sure, on Amendment Number 2. Amendment Number 2.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. I'm just, is there a fiscal note for this and previous amendments?
Mr. Wright?
Madam Chair, that, to me, would be up to the committee to request.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
We are the Finance Committee. We're giving raises to attorneys and, I guess, all other exempt employees in the previous amendment. I'm just curious. You know, we got rid of a motor fuel tax halfway there today, so I'm just wondering what the bill is.
We will get further information. On the fiscal notes, if need be.
Madam Chair, I do have the cost on Amendment Number 1, and that is approximately $13,211,900 for the executive branch. I don't have that total in front of me. For the legislative branch, $2,344,600 would be the cost for the legislative branch. The other $13,211,900, whatever the legislative branch minus that, that would be the cost for the executive branch. And also part of this $494,900 is represented in the mental health bill.
Thank you. Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Wright, could you go, Amendment Number 2 was a little quick for me. This is just employees of the legislative branch, Ledge Legal, I'm assuming, and what was the expense on that one?
Madam Chair, Representative Wall, that whatever the same amount was in the bill for the other attorneys in the executive branch.
$2.3 million.
I believe it was 10%.
Yes, it's 10%. Yeah.
Representative Wall.
No, no, I didn't mean the percentage. I meant the fiscal note. You rattled off some numbers. I thought that was for amendment number two.
Madam Chair, Representative Wool, that was for amendment number one.
Okay.
I don't have the amount for amendment number two, and that will have to be brought forward to the committee.
All right, thank you. Amendment number one. So executive branch, $13 million, legislative branch, $2.3 million, and was there one other number that I didn't get?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, the mental health aspect, and that was 494.6, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask Director of Legislative Legal, Megan Wallace. How many, Ms. Wallace, this says for attorneys in the Division of Legal and Research Services within the Legislative Affairs Agency. Can you tell me how many employees that is?
For the record, this is Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. Madam Chair, in the Legal Services Division, we have 14 attorneys.
So that would include legal and research services, correct?
Madam Chair, you're correct. There are no attorneys that work in the research department, only in the Legal Services Department, and so there are 14 attorneys in our office.
Great, thank you very much. Further discussion on amendment number two? Hearing none, I will remove my objection. Is there a further objection? Hearing none, amendment number two has been adopted. Amendment number three by Representative Ortiz. Is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move amendment number three.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, amendment three would add the employees in the judicial branch to the bill so that those employees also would receive the 10% pay increase called for in the main body of the bill. The main reason for adding the judicial employees is that they are among the lowest paid in government and are having severe problems with retaining employees and hiring new employees. If this court system doesn't have sufficient staff, all the resources being dedicated to prosecutors and public defenders might indeed help them retain and hire attorneys, but delays at the court will mean that case processing becomes a bottleneck in the system, and the public will really see no change from the investment. The court is truly struggling. Some smaller courts are having to literally close their doors for temporary time periods, maybe a day or a few days, when staffing shortages mean they simply can't operate. They've had several positions posted, and they've had zero or one applicant. They're losing employees to the executive branch and to the legislative branch on a weekly basis, so it really does seem that something has to be done to address that issue. The court has over half of its staff at range 12 or below. A range 12A makes just $43,000 a year, and that is not a livable wage. The 10% raise is very reasonable given that inflation is just the past year has been around 9%. Housing costs in Anchorage, Juneau, and really every other location have skyrocketed, and these range 12s can't afford rent. And to provide a little bit more information about why we need amendment number three, Ms. Mead from the court system, General Counsel of the court system, is here to explain further why we're asking for this amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Ms. Mead can answer this. There was an action taken to strike other than justices and judges in a prior amendment. Is that action also needed here? If not, why not?
Ms. Mead.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair to Representative LeBon, the Amendment 3 does exclude justices and judges from the bill that would from this amendment, which would give a 10% pay raise to judicial branch employees. I will say that this does not run afoul of the statutes that I mentioned previously, because this does not overall raise the chart in Title 39 on its own. However, now that an amendment passed that would change the dollar amounts in Title 39, this amendment would need to cover justices and judges as well. So with the passage of Amendment 1, the additional increase provided in Amendment 3 would need to include justices and judges for the same reasons I spoke of, that is the statutes that say when something is increased, the underlying salaries for judges and justices have to increase as well.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that a yes or no? Do we need to strike those words in this amendment?
Through the chair to Representative Lebon, the answer is yes, and I'm sorry that I wasn't more concise.
Representative Lebon, would you like to offer a conceptual amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I offer the conceptual amendment to strike the words other than justices and judges in Amendment Number 3.
Hearing no objection, conceptual amendment 1 to Amendment Number 3 has been adopted. Takes us to Amendment Number 3 as amended. Ms. Mead?
Thank you very much to the chair and to the committee. I very much appreciate this amendment, and the reason that I would hope that you would find this to consider this favorably is it is true that nobody in the judicial branch is a covered employee. We do not have unionized employees. In the other branches, there are unions for many of the lower paid employees. So unlike the executive branch, we have very many employees that are at range 12 and below. And in fact, over about half of our employees are range 12 and below, and 58% are at range 14 and below. So what that means is we have 375 employees at range 12. So let me tell you what a range 12 is. A range 12 makes $43,000 a year. That comes out to about $22 an hour. I'm sure you're aware that fast food and retail and other establishments are offering $15, $18 an hour. We're looking for a workforce that will stay with us, will benefit from the training that we provide, and will not turn over. We're losing those range 12 and 14s, again, over half of our workforce, to the other branches of government and, of course, to the private sector. If the underlying bill passes and the attorneys and the other agencies receive this pay raise, as Representative Ortiz said in the introduction, it would be terrific for them. I'm all for that. But unless the court system can respond to additional filings and can have staff that enters information into CourtView and puts documents in the files and routes things up to the appropriate people, the effect on the public will be stunted. They won't see the benefit of those pay raises. So we would like to emphasize the fact that it's a system, the criminal justice system, even the civil justice system for the Department of Law and oil and gas cases, for example. We need to be able to respond to that. We, like the attorneys you heard testify earlier, are really suffering with retention and recruitment. And again, it's the lower paid folks in our branch that are struggling. I will also say for context that somebody who is paid at a range 12, again, half of our employees, at this point is eligible for food stamps if they have a family of four and are trying to live on that salary. Their take-home salary, once you subtract standard health insurance, required state withholdings, required federal withholdings, is somewhere around $2,200 a month. Again, that's half our workers. And you know what that rent is, $1,500 and more for very small apartments. And we are simply not paying a livable wage. And that is the reason that we sometimes have to close courthouse doors for 3 days, or Nome, for example, had to close or is unable to operate at full capacity because of the five clerks who are supposed to be there. We're short four, and therefore the front doors have to be locked for a couple of hours so that those clerks can be dedicated to court hearings. So that range 12 is really suffering at this point, and we would truly benefit from having the 10% pay increase represented here, given that those folks are just getting deeper in the hole, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate all that you just said and the range 12 and the lowness of that fast food type salary. And I know it doesn't come with benefits. And maybe this is just my ignorance of how all this works. And I don't need a long answer necessarily, but and I believe this would raise the numbers at those ranges and steps. Why can't you just start someone at a higher range? I mean, is that a more complicated bargaining question? I mean, instead of a 12, why not a 15 or something? And I mean, you can still increase the values of those steps and ranges, but I'm just curious, why start at a 12? And I, probably not your area, but it just the question comes to me.
Through the chair to Representative Will, we could possibly do that with a lot more money in our personal services portion of our budget. But we try to retain some parity with the executive branch so that, as somebody, one of the testifiers described earlier, a range 12 has certain levels of responsibility. It's not a semi-professional. It's something below that. Perhaps it's data entry. And we could move them up, but then everybody up the chain would need to be moved up as well. And then we'd end up with just being one would be shifted over, and I don't know that it would accomplish much without the funding from the legislature for increased salaries, which is what this comes down to.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Can you explain why, if you moved a range 12 starting out to a range, say, 14, everybody else would have to be moved up?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, well, the range 13s who have more skills right now than, say, a range 12, or at least the skills that are useful for the court system, they would, therefore, if a 12 became a 14, well, a 13 would deservedly become a 15, and, you know, a 15 would need to become a 17. So we could do that and simply relabel everybody. We would still need the funding to pay them the increased numbers, if that responds to the question.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes, thank you. And if I had just thought about it for a split second more, I would have come to that, I think. But thank you for helping me with it. Where are the top end employees of the court system fall on the range schedule?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the judges and justices have a different pay scale. So excluding them, which I'll tell you if you wish, that leaves some magistrates and some high-level employees within the administrative office, some senior staff people, could be, I think there's a handful, and I want to say three, who may be at a range 27. And our attorney staff, and we are, other than magistrate judges and justices, attorneys, off the top of my head, I want to say that I have about eight in the administrative office. They would go between a range 20, possibly up to, we might have one or two at a 24. So the more experience, for example, if we hire someone, and I can think of somebody we hired from the Department of Law, she was paid at a 24C, we would never get her unless we offered her a 24D. And so that's where that person began. So some of it depends on the experience when they arrived at the court system. We would not have the ability to go with any attorney to a 25.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Just for understanding the scale here, could you speak briefly to how the justices and judges are pays figured out?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Carpenter, judges and justices are paid under a separate, there's a statute that you set the judges and justices' salaries, except for the provisions that say if everyone gets a pay increase, they get a pay increase. The current salary for a superior court judge, which is your general trial court of general jurisdiction, we have 45 of those, is about $190,000. And I could give you the different levels if you're interested. They're all, it ranges from $161,000 for district court. The Supreme Court, there are only five of those, make $206,000 thereabouts.
What statute is that, through the chair?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, there are four different statutes depending on the level of court. I can give you, I will read them. It's 2207-090, 2215 220, 2205-140, and 2205-140. And again, those are the ones that the last time those were changed is 2006, and that was when the court had not kept pace. The judges and justices were at the very bottom nationwide, and it was a difficult task to get raises in a large amount to those statutes, and that's when they added, now judges will just keep pace with raises others get.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number three as amended? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment three as amended has been adopted. Amendment number four by Representative Josephson. Is there a motion?
At ease.
House Finance on the record at 3:15 p.m. We are at ease until 3:20 p.m. Thank you.
House Finance on the record at 3:20 p.m. We are on amendment number 4 by Representative Josephson. Do you have a motion?
Yes, I move amendment 4.
There's been an objection. Representative Josephson.
I would first like to amend amendment 4 conceptually such that it would exclude amendment 3. The effect would be that the judiciary and its employees would not receive the additional increase in pay I'm seeking in amendment 4.
Is there an objection to conceptual amendment 1? Hearing none. Representative Josephson.
Amendment 4 speaks to the bill as written. The bill has now been modified to include everyone who works in a courthouse, which is great, except that I don't think the court system is seeking the increase I'm asking for attorneys. So it's as written, G.7, amendment number 4, effectively excluding amendment 3, which was adopted.
Representative Carpenter, is there an objection?
No.
Representative Thompson?
I'm just not understanding.
Representative Josephson?
Sure. The amendment 4, has the effect of giving a pay increase that I think is necessary to retain lawyers, public employee lawyers. And I think the court system is pleased with where it is after Amendment 3, but isn't seeking to be added to Amendment 4. And therefore, it's as written, less Amendment 3. So the conceptual part is save or less Amendment 3, strike Amendment 3.
Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:23. We have Representative Josephson's staff here to explain the conceptual amendment to amendment number 4.
Thank you, Chair Merrick and members of the committee. So Representative Josephson, for the record, Elise Thornburg, staff to Representative Josephson. So starting at what has changed in this bill so far, just so we can all track piece by piece what we're going through here. So with the adoption of Amendment 1 from Representative Thompson, that was a 5% pay increase for all exempt and partially exempt employees. Then in the section of the bill, which was the guts of the original bill, which in the bill before you, the version of the bill before you that would be so the part where you have the words 10%, which is going to be
Brief at ease.
Sorry.
Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 325. Ms. Sornberg.
Elise Sornberg for the record. So I lost my spot there, but it is page one, line 14 of version G, where it says are increased by 10%. Representative Josephson's conceptual amendment would change that from 10 to 25%. The intention of his amendment as written was simply to apply to state attorneys. In the amendment, we saw amendment number three from Representative Ortiz, employees of the judicial branch were also given that same 10% increase. So what Representative Josephson proposes to do is to have the judicial branch receive an additional 10% increase, as was adopted in Amendment 3, and for state attorneys, which were the intent of the original bill, plus the legislative legal attorneys, as added by Representative Thompson, that would be an increase from 10% to 25%.
Representative Carpenter? Thank you. And Representative Josephson, can you give us the specific language that you would like to use as your conceptual amendment?
Yes. It would say effectively on Amendment 4, I guess line 4, and it would have to be configured, but essentially it would say something to the effect of, quote, the increase on line 14, page 1, from 10 to 25% is not operative for court system employees, justices, and judges.
Close quote.
Thank you. Is there questions? I see no questions regarding conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 4. I will remove my objection. Great, thank you. That takes us to Amendment 4 as amended.
Thank you. So I appreciate the committee's time, but I do want to explain why I am encouraging you to adopt such an ambitious, but I think completely appropriate pay raise. The first thing is we need to remember that attorneys have options and can work in the private sector, and some may say that's wonderful, they should go do that. But that won't change the fact that we need them to work in the public sector on behalf of the Alaska people. That we can't change that. We need those people. We should remember that we have heard and we know that the agency, the Department of Law, for example, and principally, contracts out at a rate of as high as $600 an hour for expertise. Now, they're still going to need to do that. We've typically done that with, for example, Morrison and Forster, a D.C. and San Francisco firm on oil and gas matters. But we also heard testimony that when we grow the talent in the oil and gas section, for example, they leave because we're paying them $75,000 or $80,000 a year. The first day prior, the day prior to convening, I had a meeting with the Attorney General, Ms. Mills and Mr. Skidmore. And the Attorney General and his team said, and I have it in my notes, I was meeting with my staff right down the hall in the fakes room, and what we heard was that municipal attorneys start at $87,000. That's what they start at. We start our attorneys at $60,000. So under the bill, we're proposing, and it's very generous of us, a 15% hike, and that would bring the starting salary to around $69,000. That's nice, and it's especially nice in combination with Representative Klayman's bill, which would offer them a bonus for this coming fiscal year, and that makes may hold them here. But the $69,000, albeit generous, is not going to do the job sufficiently. They're not going to want to, I think, stick around. And you might say, Representative Josephson, why don't we just abandon this whole thing? If they're not fully devoted to the task at hand, what are we doing? You should have heard, we heard some powerful testimony today, but you should have heard the testimony in House State Affairs. And I summarized some of that for you last week. The other thing I would note is that the starting salary in Washington State, and I have it here, is $69,000. Now, in Seattle, that may not be a great wage. In Yakima, it may be a perfectly great wage. But all we've done with the bill as written is to match Washington State. And of course, there are geolocation differences. But I'm testing the tolerance for the committee to recognize that these are highly skilled people. They keep us safe. They keep our children safe. They went to 4 years of college, 3 years of law school. They have sometimes $100,000 of debt. They passed a bar. We have one of the toughest bars in the country, and we should pay them accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. If the bill sponsor could explain to me why the original bill didn't start at 25%, if it's important to achieve that number. I'm a little confused, if you could help me.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, that's a perfectly good question. I'll tell you, when we draft a bill like this, it's sort of decisions are made fast sometimes. But I think it took further fact-finding. For example, I didn't know, perhaps I should have, that municipal attorneys started at $87,000. And I hadn't heard the compelling testimony from our attorneys. And I hadn't heard once again from the department about the incredible turnover in its ranks. And so, you know, I'll take the blame for starting at a lower number than I should have.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. I guess I am very comfortable with the original bill at the 10%. I don't know that I can say for certain that a few thousand, you know, $6,000 or $7,000 a year, I don't know what the exact amount is, but I don't know that that is going to increase somebody's satisfaction with the work that they're doing enough to retain them. I think that looking at meaningful change, like including childcare or student loan repayment or anything you can do really to boost morale in this, incredibly difficult job, especially for our criminal attorneys and some of the hard cases that they're prosecuting. I just don't know that they're leaving just because of the pay. I think that there's other factors that we need to consider. Probably improving our benefits would go a long way, but I think just to say we're going to fix our retention problem by going from 10% to 25% on the raises, I'm just not convinced that's the answer. So I'll continue to listen to the debate. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representatives Ortiz and then Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I had much the same question as the representative from Sand Lake. But I would also, I guess I would like to ask the question, how, if we were to adopt this amendment, how would that impact the existing fiscal note that's before us? What would the cost be?
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, if my memory is right, the fiscal note on just the attorneys, and we've got all of them except workers' comp attorneys, they're classified, that's an answer to a previous question. I think it was, I'm going to look at my staff, but I think it was in the range of $8 million. So it would be I guess, $16 million.
We'll take a brief at ease.
House Finance on the record at 3:35 p.m. Representative Josephson.
I believe the fiscal note would grow from $8 to $20 million.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Since the court system has such a so many additions and so many effects, if this happens, this is going to happen here, different departments over there, I'm wondering if this would have a waterfall effect on other areas of the court system.
Ms. Mead?
Thank you for the record. Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair to Representative Thompson, it is my understanding that Amendment 4 would essentially exclude the court system so that it really is 25% for the attorneys. Due to the conceptual amendment that I heard a few moments ago, the judiciary salaries would increase by the 10% under Amendment 3, but not an additional 15% as proposed in Amendment 4 for the attorneys.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I certainly understand where the Representative Josephson's coming from, and he makes some very good arguments. People going to school for many years, incurring debt, could get better jobs in the private sector, could get better jobs via municipality. We did add 5% already with Amendment Number 1. So the bill as it stands with the 10% plus the 5%, we're looking at a 15% increase already. This last amendment would bring it up to 30 overall, which I guess I have a little issue with, thinking of all the other state employees that could probably be happy to get a raise of 5% or 6 or 7 or 10. I think the testifier earlier today, and I don't want to quote because I don't remember exactly, but there's many years with no percentage increase. Mr. Wright mentioned a 1, a 2, and a 3, single digits. I know the university went many years without any raises for any of their employees. So I'm certainly not questioning that these attorneys deserve more. I'm not so convinced that if we give them a 15% raise, they're all going to walk out saying, no, we needed 30. Sorry, got to go, especially based on the history that we heard that there's been many years with very little raises. And I'm not trying to talk anyone out of the amendment, but it gives me a little pause to give one group a 30% raise on a rainy Tuesday afternoon. And what about, I've heard from operators in Fairbanks, equipment operators, saying, man, the private sector is paying a lot more than the state, and we're losing operators. I know these are all collective bargaining type discussions that way out of my area of expertise, and I know we can't just give teachers a pay raise, but I know teachers are having a hard time too, and I bet if they got a 30% raise, they would, kids would be reading blazes. I don't know. I have a little, you know, to go from 10 to 15 and now to 30 is a bit of a jump, and not that they don't deserve it. I'm sure they do, as do social workers, as do a lot of other people, so I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 4? Seeing none, Representative Lebon, do you maintain your objection?
I do maintain my objection.
Thank you. With that, Madam Clerk, if you would please call the roll on Amendment Number 4 as amended.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Lebon?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
Pass.
Representative Rasmussen? Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Wohl?
Yes.
Representative Carpenter? Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
No.
Representative Wohl?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Merrick?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
3 yay, 8 nay.
And with a vote of 3 yeas and 8 nays, Amendment Number 4 has failed to be adopted.
Madam Chair?
Representative Josephson.
Move a conceptual amendment. And I'll do it very quickly. It's Amendment 4. Line 3 would become 15 rather than 25, resulting in a 20% approximately pay increase for the attorneys. And the net result would be that a starting attorney would make $69,000. That's probably less than half the staff in the building, maybe, which is great. I love our staff. It would bring them to parity or on par with a Washington State first-year lawyer. That's my move.
Thank you. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:42 p.m. Representative Josephson, can you please restate what would be Amendment Number 5?
Yes, Amendment 5 would provide, here's what it would do. Line 1, page 1, line 14, the 10 would become a 15, so that the increase in pay for attorneys and ALJs, administrative law judges, would in the net result would be 20% pay raise.
Thank you.
And again, the court system would not be included in the 10 to 15% increase.
Thank you. I will object. Madam Clerk, if you could call the roll on Amendment Number 5.
Representative Lebon.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wohl.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter. Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Merrick.
No.
6 yay, 5 nay.
And with a vote of 6 yay and 5 nay, Amendment Number 5 has been adopted. We have no further amendments. Is there discussion on House Bill 226? Hearing none, I'm going to hold this bill, and we are going to ask for a new fiscal note that has all the amendments incorporated. With that, we are going to move to House Bill 416, Bonuses for Non-Union Employees by House Judiciary. This bill is being carried by Representative Clayman, and this is our second hearing. We last heard this on April 29th, and amendments were due yesterday, and we did not receive any amendments. I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 416. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Higgins. Again, I work for the Department of Law, Civil Division. Retention bonuses are a great idea. The reason that I want to speak to them here is because of our support staff. The retention bonuses that were in HB 281 provided increases for our staff that are needed. In particularly, I want to focus on the fact that at the Civil Division, we are at the high risk of losing paralegals and associate attorneys to private sector because currently those employees are not part of the GGU and they are not covered by HB 226. Have conversations with these people and they talk about the private firms who are coming to get them. If you take the support away, a structure collapses. I don't know if we're past the amendments, but with the increase in HB 280 in 226, take the bonuses for the attorneys and give it to the support staff. They need it. We need to keep them, and we need to keep the department moving. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Higgins. I see no questions. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify? Is there anyone online wishing to testify? With that, I am closing public testimony on House Bill 416. Do we have further discussion? Hearing none, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 416, version 32-LS1675/A from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, House Bill 416 is moved from committee. Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:54 p.m. And with that, we are going to continue our discussion of House Bill 283, Version G, the capital budget. We started this discussion this morning, and there were a few questions that we were had unanswered. And with that, I will open it up for member questions. Representative Carpenter.
Chair, so I have questions on the language section that we haven't yet got to. Are we going to go through that? And I can hold my questions until after we've gone through it, or I can just ask my questions and get us all confused.
I believe we did go through the language section, but I would like to ask Legislative Finance to be here to answer those questions regarding language.
Okay, then I'll hold my questions.
Thank you. Anything further? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair and through the Chair. I think my questions would go to someone from DOT, probably.
Great, thank you. Yes, we do have folks from DOT online. It looks like we have quite a few people from DOT. We have Don Panome, who is the Administrative Services Director, that we could start with. Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair. Mr. Panone, I'm wondering if you, hopefully you have the bill in front of you, but on page 9, lines 25 and 26, it lists $30 million for state-funded road and bridge completion. And it says House Districts 1 through 40. And I was just curious, do you have a list of the roads and bridges that are included for that funding?
Mr. Panone.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Dom Panone. Representative Rasmussen, that allocation, I believe, was for any projects that needed additional funds, any existing state projects or future state projects that need existing funds to complete. So that would be at the determination of the department.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So does the department have any projects earmarked? I guess I'm a little curious where the $30 million comes from, and I think for transparency's sake, it's helpful if we know where that, I mean, $30 million is intended to be spent.
Mr. Panone?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we could certainly provide a list of potential or targeted projects back to you or the committee, but at this time there is not any intended or named projects for those funds.
And we also have Deputy Commissioner of DOT John Binder online. Mr. Binder, do you have any further information for Representative Rasmussen?
For the record, this is John Binder, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Transportation. Yes, I don't have any additional information beyond what Mr. Panone just provided. We'd be happy to provide some potential project listing there, but as I said, nothing designated at this time.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, through the chair. So, Mr. Binder, did the department request these funds, or how did they come to be in this budget? Are you aware of that?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I would have to defer back to Dom or Admin Services Director for that question, please.
Mr. Panone?
Through the chair, for the record, Dom Panone, Admin Services Director. Representative Rasmussen, I don't believe this is a governor's requested item. I believe it's a legislator added item.
Thank you. And we're going to take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 4:08 p.m. And we will go to Representative Rasmussen, but first we have Michael Partlow, the Capital Budget Coordinator with Legislative Finance Division, to help Representative Rasmussen with her question. Thanks for being here, Mr. Partlow.
For the record, Michael Partlow with Legislative Finance.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair and through the Chair. We just heard from Department of Transportation that on page 9, lines 25 and 26, there was a $30 million addition, and I was just trying to understand, since it didn't come from the governor's budget, where that was added in.
Through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, that was added by the Senate.
Follow-up?
And then do you happen to have the total number that was added to the capital budget from the governor's proposed just in the Senate?
Through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't have that directly in front of me, and I would probably regret guessing on the spot, but I'll be happy to provide it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz. Representative Carpenter, then Wool, then LeBron. Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Can I swing myself down to the bottom of the list?
Certainly. Representative Wool.
This is real easy. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a question. I know you have about 12 people from DOT on the line. So this is a, I'm going to rephrase the question I asked earlier today. And I think it's germane because we've been talking about the port. It's called the Port of Alaska by in people in Anchorage, and it is in Anchorage. And I'm guessing my question for DOT is there any state relationship to this Port of Alaska, or is that just a moniker?
Mr. Pannone?
For the record, Don Pannone, I'd like to defer to Eric Taylor, who's on the line.
Eric Taylor, welcome to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and help Representative Wool. Mr. Taylor, are you on mute? Okay. We are not hearing from Mr. Taylor. Andy Mills, the legislative liaison for DOT, are you available to help answer that question?
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Yes, for the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Apologies that Mr. Taylor was not available. He was on the phone specifically given his expertise. So through the Chair, Representative Bull, on the freight plan, as part of our long-range transportation plan, there is the freight plan. And not getting to your specific question, which you can give me again, but the earlier question was related to a holistic statewide approach to freight and cargo. And that's what Eric was going to be on the line to let you know, that from a DOT perspective, our freight plan as part of our long-range transportation plan, which we are developing now and getting ready to roll out a new edition of that, does have a member of the Port of Alaska, Port of Anchorage, as part of that team that coordinates on that planning effort. But that DOT has no specific planning or directional efforts that the director for it is at the municipal effort.
Representative Wool.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. So what I'm gathering what you're saying is the state has no direct involvement in the port. It's a municipal port, probably like all the ports in Alaska, unlike the airport, which is state-run, and all the other airports in Alaska. So, but you have a freight plan, a sort of overarching freight plan that you referred to, a holistic freight plan, and I guess you haven't rolled anything out, but I'd be interested to hear more about that, because if you look at all the freight that comes into Alaska by all different means, I guess road or air or boat, ocean, you probably have pretty good numbers on all that and where it comes and where it goes. And we hear that 50% of it, I believe, comes through the port in Anchorage and is distributed to 90% of the communities and I guess sort of the southern part of the state. isn't as affected by the port in Anchorage. But I'd be curious, and maybe you don't have any data yet, but just what your, whatever group this is, I guess it's DOT Freight report, what you guys see as a, you know, 10-year plan, or what the future, how to attack some of these issues that we're hearing about from the municipality of Anchorage regarding their port, and what you guys think of holistically as far as freight and solving any problems that we have or problems with the port of Anchorage, which is the one we're talking about.
Mr. Mills?
Yes, Andy Mills again. Through the chair, Representative Wolf, thank you again for that. We're certainly happy to provide you a previous copy of the freight plan and some of the efforts that have been going, but the freight plan is a long-term planning document like our long-range transportation plan that accounts for the future capacity needs and what we would anticipate that our multimodal and intermodal transportation system statewide would need when it comes to the future demands. And so that's really what that planning document it represents, is the potential future capacity. And so we take inputs from stakeholders such as the Port of Alaska and get information. And beyond that, I don't think we have specific numbers as to their current operations, but I think we have an idea of what the future looks like, having that team member, again, part of that planning team, and giving us an idea of what the future potential would be, and that translates into what roads and bridges and other infrastructure would need to accommodate.
Thank you, and last follow-up, if I may, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, and thank you for that information. And I guess if you can tell me just off the top of your head, and if you can't, that's fine, and I don't deal with freight at your level, that's for sure. I mean, I receive it once in a while, but as far as Alaska, I'm assuming most of it comes in by ship, barge or ship, and that less by land, driving up on the Alcan, and even less by air. Do you have just off, you know, back of the envelope, what percentage of all of our freight comes in through ship? And I'm assuming it's a pretty high number.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I like Mr. Partlow before, would be reticent to give a wrong answer, but I do believe I have heard it somewhere in the neighborhood of 80-something percent by sea, but I don't know that to be a fact. I know that Ted Stevens International, of course, has a very high cargo throughput. In fact, I know in the world, at the beginning of COVID, it was the number one airport in the world for cargo. But as compared to the port, I don't have those numbers offhand.
Okay, thank you. I guess I knew that about the airport in Alaska. But thank you for that information. I'd be curious to hear about the results of your freight study.
Thank you. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if Mr. Partlow would like to join us again, I would appreciate if you would invite him forward.
Yes. We love our capital budget coordinator from Legislative Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, on the same page that Representative Rasmussen was asking about state-funded road and bridge, there's Alaska Marine Highway monies. There's $30 million that's federal money, and I just to confirm, that money was secured by our congressional delegation through that kind of creative budgeting process, that Alaska was able to qualify for those dollars, and maybe Maine also. Is that the source of the $30 million, or does that ring a bell?
Again, for the record, Michael Partlow with Legislative Finance, through the chair, Representative Lebon. You are correct. That is part of the $200 million in federal funding for rural ferry service that was part of the federal infrastructure bill.
And then if I may follow up, Madam Chair, my follow-up question is, right below it, there's the $20 million. Was that in the governor's original budget?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, yes. The $20 million is more of a normal year expense for maintenance and repair of vessels, whereas the $30 million was specifically for the design of a new mainline vessel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I think I'll ask this question, and it might be out of left field, but it's a language portion question from Section 14 on page 57. Section 14, Section 1. Okay, so we're talking about reappropriations, I think, here. The expended and unobligated balances of the following appropriations are reappropriated to the Department of Health. And these are reappropriations from the Department of Health and Social Services, so to do with the split between, that split HESA. So the question that I have is, starting on this first number one under Section 14, the 2007 budget for Department of Health and Social Services, specifically the Medicaid Management Information System completion, and there's a dollar figure of $12 million and change. I guess what it's saying is being appropriated or reappropriated to Medicaid Management Information System completion. So the question that I have is, what is the status of the Medicaid Management Information System completion from 2007 that we still have $12 million to reappropriate? That's 15 years ago. Can you help me understand why that's in the budget now?
Mr. Partlow.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. I wish I had a more precise answer for you. You are correct in pointing out that it is a very old capital appropriation. As long as there is activity on one of those capital appropriations, it essentially can go on in perpetuity. The money would automatically lapse if they were to go several years, or not necessarily automatically, but if they were to go several years without actually expending any of the money or showing the Office of Management and Budget that they were actively working on that project, it would certainly be considered for the legislature to reappropriate that money for a different purpose. Typically, a capital project is for a five-year period, but it can go longer. And again, the sort of operative word there is ongoing activity.
Representative Carpenter.
I feel like a bloodhound right about now. So can you help me further by defining what ongoing activity might be as it pertains to a Medicaid Management Information System? And they, in 2007, they used the word completion. So 15 years ago, we said we need to complete this system, and we're going to give you a number of dollars that currently is $12 million, so I don't know how much was actually spent in the last 15 years. So what would continued effort to complete that system look like in 15 years? Maybe this is a question for Hess, somebody from Health.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, I believe the department could speak more precisely as to what their ongoing activity is on this, but it's certainly an ongoing project, and to my knowledge, they are not at the completion point, certainly.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So on line two from the 2009 budget, so we're at a few years later, again for the Department of Health, statewide electronic health information exchange system. We're talking almost $24 million is being reappropriated to a statewide electronic health information exchange system. Is this a similar situation as you described in the first section where there's a capital project that is continually being worked on over the last 13 years?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, that is my understanding. And I was just given a very helpful note to remind me that those particular projects have a lot of Fed authority, which is not state dollars sort of sitting in a bank account. It is the authority to expend federal funds when they come in for those projects.
Okay.
Thank you. And Representative Carpenter, we're working to get OMB here as well as the one from Health and Social Services.
So I guess it will be helpful to know whether the $12 million or the $23 million is federal dollars or state dollars, because this doesn't tell me that.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, we'll be happy to follow up to get you more details on those specific projects, certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Foster.
A whole bunch of them here, Madam Chair, that I have questions on that are older than 10 years old, and it's double-digit million dollars.
Okay, we're working on getting Director Steiniger here to help you with that question. Representative Foster.
Representative Rasmussen had a good question earlier. I think it was how much was the governor's capital budget, and then how much did the Senate add? Was that? And I'm just looking at one of the documents here. It's document C. It was kind of in the middle of our packet, dated April 28th. So that was just last Thursday before we adopted our new CS this morning. And it looks like the governor had a total of $311 million for a capital budget, just UGF, not designated or federal or other. And then when we adopted the Senate's version, which is how CS won, that number went up to 707. So it looks like the Senate added about just shy of, or it's $396 million, so about $400 million. So governor about $300 million, and then the Senate about $400 million. So.
Thank you. And Representative Rasmussen.
Through the chair, I was hoping that Mr. Dave Karp was online to hopefully help answer Representative Wohl's question a little bit earlier. Regarding the port of Alaska, we were speaking about how freight comes into Alaska, and so I was just hoping that you could kind of help us with how much comes through the Port of Alaska specifically. I'm not sure if you have that or if you could speak to how the freight management goes on your end.
Thank you. And we have David Karp with Saltchuk. If you could place yourself on the record. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Karp, Senior Vice President, Managing Director for Alaska for Saltchuk. And we operate Tilt Maritime, just for context. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen and Representative Wohl. I don't have the specific of the volumes in terms of the overall volume of freight coming through the Port of Alaska. It is a substantial majority, and I know that Mayor Brownson's team is on the line, and there are a number of slide decks that have been made available, and I'm sure that we can get that information very easily. I think the broader question that folks have been asking is, what is the, you know, what are the alternatives to the Port of Alaska as it pertains to our ability to bring significant volumes in? And basically, you know, I can speak from our perspective, and we spend a lot of time talking about this amongst the port users. The other port facilities that are available on the road system, it isn't necessarily that they're not viable ports, but in the context of being, you know, the main receiving facility for the vast majority of the commodities that come into Alaska's largest city, and the types of vessels that are operated, you'll hear terms like ro-ro and lo-lo, which really refer to roll-on, roll-off ships and lift-on, lift-off ships, and the infrastructure that's required and the types of docking facilities to bring vessels in on a regular basis into those communities. You know, there's a, you know, from our perspective, we look at that from a business continuity point of view. Seward is the facility or the port that we sort of view as the most viable from a business continuity perspective. But when you really start to look at the impacts on surface transportation and, you know, on our ship alone, over 400 containers coming off a vessel twice a week, our proximity to the market is a key consideration for us. And that's obviously why we call the Port of Alaska home. I hope that answers the question, but I'm happy to clarify.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Mr. Karp, would it increase the cost for consumers, say, in interior Alaska, if the port of Seward suddenly became more utilized and you had to either truck or find means of rail to get goods from Seward to interior Alaska?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, that's a difficult question to ask, because there are a number of variables that would be associated with looking at the transportation infrastructure from Seward to the interior. But I think it's a reasonable conclusion to draw that the closer we get to the markets that we're serving, the more efficient we can be in providing the final mile transportation to the markets.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. Are you aware, through the chair, are you aware of any road access to the interior from the Seward or Kenai Peninsula area? If there were, say, a rock fall on the Seward Highway that forced a shutdown on the highway for an extended period of time?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I am not. I do think it's worth pointing out, and this is one of the variables we look at in our business continuity planning, is that one of the things that makes the committee of Seward unique from a you know, from an alternative point of view is the fact that we have both rail and highway access. Directly to answer your question, no, there's only one road.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Karp, in your just recent discussion here, looking at alternative supports, et cetera, you didn't mention at all Whittier. Is Whittier considered to be a viable option for being a port of Alaska that could deliver goods throughout the state of Alaska?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I do know, and I don't have an abundance of technical data sitting in front of me here because of, this was a relatively short notice call, but in our business continuity planning efforts, and certainly predicated both before and after the 2018 earthquake, we've taken a fairly comprehensive look at really what it would take for us to relocate both short-term and long-term our operations. You know, we have found that the Port of Seward is the preferred alternative for us. A lot of it has to do not just with water depth and docking capacity, but also shoreside infrastructure. If you're familiar with either the towed or the Matson vessels, they require significant square footage. In our situation, we're offloading using large ramps. So you know, again, without getting into the technicalities, we've determined that Seward is the best alternative. And again, from a business continuity perspective, with the Port of Alaska and Anchorage being the one that absolutely makes the most sense, again, due to its proximity to market.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see we now have Director Steiniger in the room, and we also have Sylvan Robb, the Assistant Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Mr. Steiniger, welcome back. If you could come forward, and Representative Carpenter had a few questions.
Thank you. For the record, Neil Steiniger, Director, Office of Management and Budget.
Good afternoon.
Representative Carpenter.
You're the chair. Thank you. So my questions earlier were in regards to the reappropriations found in our work draft G, Section 14, Department of Health specifically. There's a Medicaid Management Information System completion dollar figure, a little over $12 million that was from the 2007 budget. Can you help me understand why a 15-year-old appropriation is still being carried on for a system completion original appropriation?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. I may leave some of the details to Director Robb. However, the appropriations there, as I'm sure you're aware, are ones that are still ongoing that need to be sorted into the two new departments. The Medicaid Management Information System has been an IT project that's been ongoing for quite some time, which has had, I believe, several appropriations over the years. Not all of this money listed there is state general fund. A lot of this is federal funds as well. And so as the project progresses and there's, you know, changes to the system, in order to accept some of the federal funds, those projects have continued on. And remained active in the state's accounting system. And so any active projects were split into the two new departments. And if I could defer to Director Robb, if she has any additional details specifically to MMIS and that that project status, which might help.
Thank you, Ms. Robb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Sylvan Robb, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Health and Social Services. What Director Steininger just laid out is very much the case for these projects. As I'm sure you're aware, Representative Carpenter, the Medicaid Management Information System is a very complex system. It has taken many years to get that project stood up, and we are still using those funds. Additionally, we're in the process of ensuring that all expenditures against some of the older capital projects are properly accounted for before we close those projects as we move from the Department of Health and Social Services into the new department. So we anticipate that as we work through this, we may find that several of these projects may be able to be closed, but at this time, we're still in the process of ensuring that all of our T's are crossed and I's are dotted, if you will.
Representative Carpenter.
So in the MMIS system, using the acronym that you used, sir, Medicaid Management Information System, if we had to take a stab at it right now, what percentage complete is that system?
Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I don't have the information at my fingertips for you right now, Representative. I can get you an answer as soon as possible.
Representative Carpenter.
Okay. So, yeah, I think that would be important. 15 years is an awful long time to be carrying a project on, and doesn't pass a common sense test that we would actually want to drag something out that long. So follow up for the second line. There's a statewide electronic
brief
health.
It is.
Brief it is.
I'm sorry. Could you just?
House Finance on the record at 435. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And my apologies. We're on page 57 of the budget document, version G. Okay, so the second question is regarding the statewide electronic health information exchange system. Has a $23.9 million reappropriation, and this is from budget year 2009. Was that creating an exchange, information exchange system? Is this also a situation where the health information exchange system is still ongoing 13 years later?
Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb with Health and Social Services. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, yes, the health information exchange, or the HIE, is an ongoing project. So the health information exchange is a tool that allows healthcare providers within the state to connect their electronic health record systems. The existence of the Alaska HIE is in state statute and is also a requirement of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that the state have an HIE. So we are continuing to work. We're not the only state that has had a very long runway to standing up a health information exchange. As I say, it's a requirement of the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services, so it's something that all states are working on. And it has been a lengthy process for almost everyone to get these health information exchanges stood up. And of course, as we all know, technology is always changing, so as healthcare and technology change, the project has morphed a little bit over time.
Okay, follow up.
Then yes, follow up.
I think I would like to add that one to the list to be able to understand how much of the $23.9 million is state funds versus federal funds. And then I would jump down to number five, that is electronic health record incentive payments for $36.5 million from the fiscal year 2011 budget, and ask why are we carrying forward $36.5 million from the 2011 budget for electronic health record incentive payments? And again, how much of that is state money and how much is federal?
Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, we are no longer making those incentive payments for participation in the health information exchange. As I did mention, the department is in the middle of an active effort to ensure that all of our capital appropriations are cleaned up, and so we had some reluctance to close out a few projects before we completed that cleanup process to ensure that we don't leave anything hanging as we're working through the process of splitting the department. As I'm sure you can see as you look at the reappropriation list of projects to the new Departments of Health and Department of Family and Community Services, we have a lot of capital projects. And so it's an ongoing process that we had hoped to be done with a little bit sooner, but we anticipate being done with very soon.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I guess if there's one benefit, and I don't know whether this is just a question that I overlooked in the last budget cycles, or maybe this is a benefit of the splitting of the two departments, but it would kind of seem logical to me that before we ask for a reappropriation of money for any of these programs, we would first know whether we actually need it. And if we're no longer participating in the electronic health record incentive program, then there's $36.5 million that's sitting there. It's either federal money or state money, and I don't know which by looking at this budget that is either returnable to the federal government because we don't need it anymore, or it's state money that can be used somewhere else. And for the sake of time, I just want to say that within the Department of Health Section 14, there are a number of reappropriations that are a decade or more older, and I'm going to have the same questions for each and every single one of them. So would it be possible to just put a blanket request to understand anything that's over a decade? Let's have a conversation about, is this necessary?
Mr. Steiniger?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Carpenter, we can very quickly provide you a list of every active appropriation within the current Health and Social Services through our annual report that OMB puts together called the Capital Appropriation Status Report. Has all that information, so we can put together a quickly summarized list of all of those appropriations. What I will say is, for some of these older appropriations, particularly the ones that are primarily federal funds, as we worked through this process to split the department into two departments, most of the administrative work has been around, you know, some of the other issues in breaking the department apart. There's a lot of administrative work involved here. So when we looked at all of these older capital appropriations, the decision was made, let's figure out where they should live, and we can, as we work through the transition of the department into two departments, work through figuring out which of these have just been kept active for administrative convenience and close them out next year. But as we were working through the other administrative tasks, know, in terms of the hierarchy of what's most valuable to making the transition effective and successful, you know, this was something that we could put to the side as a task to work through as we're transitioning, but not necessarily have ready in time for this capital budget process. But it is a very good question, and keeping capital projects on that are no longer necessary, especially if they have state funds, but even without state funds, just creates some administrative burden that's, you know, unnecessary at times. And working through this transition to the two different departments, you know, really one of the goals here is to be able to put more focus on some of the administrative issues, clear up some of this work, and, you know, spend more time on value add opportunities.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Don't disagree with your logic. I understand the decision that was made. We're at a decision. We have to make a decision about the budget now. Capital spending, and there's a request for reappropriation. So I don't know where it falls in your timeline for getting to it, but it's now before this body and this committee, and it's on my agenda. So I would appreciate some help in understanding now, not almost $100 million is necessary to be reappropriated this year, or is there opportunity for funding other things that, that are now a priority, where this money that's over a decade old is no longer? I need some help in understanding that now. Thank you.
Yes.
Anything further, Mr. Steiniger?
No, thank you, but we will provide that report.
Okay, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First of all, I really appreciate the line of questioning by Representative Carpenter. And just so that I make sure I am understanding this correctly, Representative Carpenter roughly totaled $100 million of areas where he has questions. Can I assume that those $100 million were appropriated year after year after year since the origination of these programs, and that they were expended year after year after year? Or is this – that's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, these would be appropriations for – on each it should list the year of the appropriation and then expended over time as the project goes on. Part of the annual review is looking at capital projects to see have they had meaningful expenditures or ongoing obligations to the projects on an annual basis to see whether or not they should be administratively terminated to have the effective lapse date triggered. And any that have had meaningful activity in the recent years get continued on each year. A lot of the funds remaining on those older projects tend to be federal authority, so there's less incentive to go to those projects for reappropriation because there's not necessarily state funds tied to them. But again, that report, the capital appropriation status report produced annually by OMB, shows that detail of the unobligated amounts of both general fund or federal authority on the projects, and will provide a summary that shows all of these projects to show you which have general fund that we're looking to assign to these two new departments and which are simply federal authorities for ongoing programs.
Follow up?
Again, I'm sorry if I'm a little bit slow to the take here, but for example, in line 23, it speaks about the program beginning in 2011. So am I correct in understanding that in 2011, $36 million and $518,800 were put forward to for electronic health and record incentive payments. And since that time, we've been in the process of spending down that $36 million, or has there been – is that just the correct understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, correct. And on that program specifically, those were incentives sent out to – medical practitioners for setting up health record systems. And so, I can't necessarily speak in the specifics, but since there are grants out, there may still be obligations of, bills yet to receive as those things have been done. But Director Robb may have more detail on that, but we may need to just get back to you on that specific.
Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, ASD for Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we'll provide the report to all the members of the committee that Representative Carpenter was interested in seeing, and that will provide good information on the status of the projects, especially some of those older projects. Like Director Steininger noted, most of these projects where it appears that there's a great deal of funding remaining, that is primarily federal funding that we don't have GF match for, and so it's not money that would be available to be reappropriated for other projects. But we'll certainly provide the complete list so that you have insight into the status.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have Representative Carpenter and then Representative LeBon.
Thank you. Very quick question. Follow up on the line of questioning there. Just to be very clear, the dollar figures that are listed within these reappropriations, are those dollar figures representing what was appropriated in the year that the original appropriation was made or follow-on reappropriations, or is that the dollar figure that remains in the reappropriation this year?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I don't actually have a copy of the bill in front of me to see the exact language. If you don't mind, if I could get a copy real quick.
I believe they are bringing one to you.
Page 57.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the numbers listed here are the original appropriation amounts. Yes.
Follow-up?
So then I guess the question would then be what is actually being reappropriated would be on the list that you can provide.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And one additional follow-up.
Yes. Representative Carpenter. And Representative Lebon, was that the question?
Actually, Madam Chair, I was going to ask the same question as a follow-up to the member from Ketchikan to see was that the original number or that's the remaining number. So I appreciate that line of questioning.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
I remember now. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Whatever remaining amount of federal funds that is sitting in one of these accounts or they're probably not per se. Anyway, wherever that money is actually being set aside, and I'm thinking technically, is it in Jafonzi or wherever it is, does that mean that there is interest being earned from those federal dollars that are usable by the state if there isn't an appropriation for or state match, or is that money just sitting there not doing anything?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the federal funds is really receipt authority, so it's not necessarily cash that we have on hand. Most of these federal programs, not every federal program, but most federal programs act on a reimbursable basis. So we send either monthly or quarterly bills to the federal government, and then they reimburse. And so there wouldn't, generally speaking, wouldn't be cash sitting in the bank earning interest.
Thank you. I look forward to the report.
Thank you. Anything further on House Bill 283? Seeing none, I will note that public testimony for House Bill 283, the capital budget, will be tomorrow, Wednesday, May 4th, from 4 to 6 p.m. I will remind callers that they need to call in by 5:45, and testimony will be limited to 2 minutes. And I also encourage folks, if you would like to submit written testimony, you can send that to house.finance@akleg.gov. And tomorrow will be a 9 a.m. meeting that's subject to change on the floor. We will consider House Bill 357, naming the Insook Beck Bridge. So with that, at 4:51 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.